Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, writer Jeff Sparrow goes in search of Paul Robeson in his latest book, No Way But This. Jeff Sparrow is a writer, editor and broadcaster and an honorary fellow at Victoria University. He writes a fortnightly column for The Guardian and contributes regularly to many other publications, as well as being a member of the 3RRR Breakfasters radio team. Jeff is the immediate past editor of the literary and cultural journal Overland and the author of several books, including Communism, A Love Story and Killing, Misadventures in Violence. And today we're going to talk about Jeff's new book, which is No Way But This, In Search of Paul Robeson. Jeff, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks for having me.
So anybody listening to your voice, and if they look at your photo in the book, will notice that you're a white fella from Australia. So how did you come to Paul Robeson?
Is it so obvious from my voice? I was working in a left-wing bookshop in Trades Hall in Melbourne in the late 90s, and we were, well, being a left-wing bookshop, we were always on the verge of going broke, and so we used to rely a lot on donations of secondhand books, usually from old members of the Communist Party or old trade unionists, old lefties of one kind or another. Very often they died and their families were donating their libraries basically to clear out the houses. And so part of my job was going around to these places and packing up all of the books and sorting them, and of course I'd end up reading a lot of the material along the way. And it was really kind of fascinating because I've got a background on the left, but my generation of the left tended to be quite utilitarian about books. So, you know, activists would focus on politics quite narrowly, whereas this generation of the old left seemed to me to be incredibly well-read and incredibly broadly read. I mean, there were often people who hadn't gone to university, very often hadn't finished high school, but they had books on philosophy and they had books on mathematics and they had books on cooking and they had books on all kinds of subjects, and they always had books on Paul Robeson. So, you know, I vaguely had heard of Paul Robeson as I knew he was a singer. I knew he sort of popped up on TV, you know, on the midday TV movies when you were sick home from school, but I had no real idea of his politics or anything like that. And I started reading these books in my job, and I became aware there was this amazing story of this man who had been so extraordinarily good at so many things. And then I began to wonder, well, why is it that someone who at one stage was probably one of the most famous people in the world was scarcely known at all? So those were the two preoccupations of the book, I guess. Partly that there was this amazing story, but secondarily to sort of examine the politics of memory, particularly in a political context, why certain stories were remembered and certain stories were forgotten, and what the significance of that was.
So the book tells the story of Paul's life, but also your travels, interviewing people that might have known him or knew somebody that did know him or certainly, you know, had some insight into his legacy. And we'll talk about sort of both aspects as we go. First of all, let's talk about Paul's father. Obviously, like, Paul was a famous figure in the 20th century. So it's perhaps surprising to learn that Paul's father was born into slavery, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, and that was something that very early on in the project kind of stunned me, that, you know, Paul Robeson died in 1976. Now, that's not so very long ago, but he was a guy who was alive at the same time I was alive, but his father was a slave in North Carolina. And it really struck me because I was researching this book during the period of this sort of upsurge of campaigning against police brutality in the US. And there were a lot of people on the American right saying, well, you know, why are people going on about racism in the US? The past is the past. It was such a long time ago. And to realize that actually slavery was, you know, only just over two generations ago kind of did my head in. And so I became fascinated with William Robeson's stories, that's Paul's father, nearly as much as Paul's story itself.
So you went to North Carolina and you spoke to some people who were descendants of the man that owned William. What was that like?
Yeah, that was quite an experience in all kinds of way, because I sort of knew that I wanted to, that was something that I wanted to pursue. I knew that very early on in the research process. And I started trying to make it happen when I was still here in Australia. And the family that had owned William Robeson was actually quite a prominent colonial family in North Carolina. And there's a website where you can read all about them. It was set up for genealogists because there were all these people who were descended from the White Robeson family. And I originally contacted that website and said, look, I'm interested in this history, I'd like to come and talk to you about it. And at first, they were incredibly, friendly. The whole thing was set up to aid genealogists. They said, yes, you know, we'll be glad to help you. And then they said, look, what's your specific interest? And I said, well, I'm interested in William Robeson, who was a slave of the Robeson family. And then they just broke all contact with me. And in a way, I guess it made me more determined to pursue it, because it brought home the point that this was still a ticklish subject in America to talk about the legacy of slavery. So here was an organization that was set up specifically for amateur historians, but this part of the history was something that they didn't want to pursue. So, I eventually tracked down other relatives using a genealogical website, and I went to visit them in a town very close to where the Robeson plantation had been. And the women I spoke to were very friendly, and, you know, they were lovely women. They went out of their way to help me and, you know, offered me food and were very kind to me. It's just that as the conversation continued and when I began to talk to them about race relationships in North Carolina today, became clear that, well, specifically they talked about how they thought the changes in race relationships had gone too far, that African Americans had become too militant, and they preferred the way things had been when they were growing up. They spoke about how they'd related to African American people as if they were family, and they said, you know, we would often call them aunt and uncle, even if we weren't related to them. And that really jumped out at me, because I'd read about that particular town, Williamston, had been a central point of the civil rights struggle during the 60s. And when I'd been reading about that, the points around which the civil rights activists had been mobilizing was an end to segregation, an end to the sort of racist laws that had prevailed in Williamstown at the time. But one of the points that specifically raised is that they wanted African Americans to be called by courtesy titles. And they were sick of African Americans being called boy if they were young, or auntie or uncle if they were old. And so it really kind of jumped out at me. Here was something that during the 60s, civil rights activists had actually, you know, had faced down the KKK and faced down police in order to overcome. Yet these older white women saw this tradition as a courtesy. And it kind of really brought home, I guess, the difference between the way that African Americans saw the past and the way that white Americans saw the past. And look, in some ways, that conversation was one that was very familiar to me as a white Australian. I mean, if you go to particularly Western Australia or the Northern Territory, you'll find very similar conversations with white Australians talking about how foreigners don't understand the relationships with Indigenous people. And if you lived here, you would understand how in the past we'd got on very well, but, people from down south have been stirring up trouble. It was kind of analogous to that, I guess. But again, it sort of drew up how much past was still a living factor in American politics today.
I'm Emily Mayhew. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So once William gains his freedom, he becomes a well-loved preacher in various communities that the family live in. But still, he's having to put up with repeated humiliations, and particularly there's one point. Tell us a story about how he's basically sacked from one position.
Yeah, I mean, this was interesting for me as well. I mean, before I began researching the book, I had a vague sense of American history, but I think there's a tendency to look at the struggle against racism in the United States as more or less a continual process that proceeds in one direction, that you start with slavery, and then racism is slowly kind of fought and is mitigated, if you see what I mean. And of course, that wasn't what happened. The struggle goes in waves and cycles. And so the period in which Paul was born, the 1890s, was really an incredible period of kind of racist counter-revolution, I guess, when the various achievements that African Americans had won since the Civil War and since the abolition of slavery were gradually kind of rolled back. And the sacking of William Robeson was, I guess, part of that process. I mean, when he escaped from slavery, he was 15 and he was illiterate. He managed to get a classical education. He'd learnt Latin and ancient Greek. He'd become a minister of religion, and he'd risen about as far as it was possible for an African-American man to rise at the time. But he'd also taken part in the protests against the racial murders that were happening in the South of America, where he and many other people in Princeton had family. And because of that all, it seems that the whites, who were the ultimate authorities in the church in which he preached, had occasioned his dismissal. So he'd gone from being a prominent, respectable and reasonably comfortable figure in Princeton to being, well, unemployed, and eventually he has to work as a dustman, hauling coal ashes around town. So this incredible sort of downfall, I guess, which is one of Paul's earliest memories of his sort of dignified, educated father having to haul ashes around Princeton. I think that actually had quite a big impact on Paul's subsequent development.
I want to skip us forward to Paul's university career, because I think it's one of the sort of instances that, you know, speaks to the character of the man. And he gets into Rutgers, which is, you know, is a quite prestigious college, and eventually he becomes a star football player, to the extent that he's subsequently been inducted into the College Football's Hall of Fame and everything. But again, at the beginning, this is a trial for him, because clearly they don't want him there.
That's right. I mean, he wins a scholarship there. He's an extraordinarily gifted student, and he's one of the first African-Americans at this prestigious all-white university. But the football coach is aware of his sporting prowess as well. He'd been a star at his local high school, and he's invited to go and try out for the college football team. And when he turns up, of course, all the other players are white, and none of the other players will speak to him. And when the whistle is blown, they all attack him, knock him unconscious, break his nose, and put him in hospital. And while he's in hospital recovering from this, his family members go and visit him, and he says to them, look, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm sick of being brutalized by white people. I don't want to play football anymore. And his father says to him, well, look, son, you're not here simply on your own behalf. You have to think of all the other African-American kids who want to go to college and who are never going to get a chance, who want to play football and who are never going to get the chance. And you have to go back out there and show that you can take whatever's dished out to you, which is, in fact, what he does. He goes back as soon as he's out of hospital. The same scene more or less plays out again. The whistle's blown. They all attack him. This time, however, someone stands on his fingers and tries to break his hand, and he loses his temper, picks up one of the white players over his head, and is about to break his back when a coach says, Roby, you're on the team, and that sort of snaps him out of it. And he goes on to become the greatest college football player of his generation, at a time when college football was really the most prestigious form of the game. And it's in a context where, even though he's the star of the entire competition, he can't travel with the rest of the team because all the transport is segregated. He can't stay in hotels with them. He can't have a drink with them. after the game, he's never invited to any of the formal social celebrations. And on the field, he's constantly a target for racialized violence. And of course, this is at a period where college football is incredibly violent. There's some extraordinary figure of the number of college students who are killed each year playing the game. And as an African-American kid playing amongst white players, he's constantly being targeted. But he's about a head and shoulders taller than most of the other players. And one of the things he discovers is that football is an area in which there is at least some latitude to fight back. And there's a great story about how very often by the end of the game, he'd be lowering these unconscious white players to the ground and then saying in this sort of loud stage whisper, oh, I'm terribly sorry. I hope I didn't hurt you there, you know, because he could get away with doing that when he was playing football in a way that he couldn't do it anywhere else.
Let's introduce Essie, Paul's soon-to-be wife here. Now, they have, I guess we could say, an unconventional relationship, but at the same time, she's present throughout his life and career. They're together on and off right up until her death, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, Eslanda is an amazing figure in her own right. And she was the subject of a biography herself, I think, came out last year. And in some ways, they make quite an unlikely pairing. And in other ways, they're very well suited. She's like him in the sense that she's incredibly, she's very high achieving. She's has a degree in science, and she's a laboratory technician when they meet, which is incredibly rare for an African-American and an African-American woman. But she's much more driven, I guess, by conventional priorities of success than Paul Robeson is, or at least more overtly so. I mean, Robeson was ambitious in his own way, but Eslanda was much more concerned about what people thought than Paul was. And in fact, if you read the Robeson biographies, there's a lot of Paul's friends who are very kind of hostile to Eslanda right from the start, who see her as incredibly uptight, incredibly snobbish, and, you know, not at all a match for Paul. Whereas I guess I try to argue that I think there's a way in which she and Paul become very reliant on each other, even when their relationship goes through up and downs. I think she becomes Paul's manager very early on, and she sacrifices her own career in order to ensure his success. And I think that there's a sense in which Paul really came to sort of depend on her determination, and that which many of his friends saw as kind of cold calculation was kind of necessary for him to establish himself in the way that that he did. And she was clearly a very intelligent woman who became a political figure in her own right. I think that in many of the accounts of Robeson, she often gets a kind of raw deal.
So in the early years of Paul's career, Eslanda and Paul are living in Harlem and the Harlem Renaissance is going on. So tell us what sort of things, both cultural and political, were happening at the time when they were there.
The Harlem Renaissance is facilitated by the great migration of African Americans from the South to the North. They're driven out of the South of America by racial violence, and they're pulled to the North by the promise of jobs in the industrial cities. And by a sort of strange sequence of events, they're able to settle in Harlem in the middle of New York. I mean, in a funny kind of way, the dynamic of segregation allows Harlem to become very black very quickly, because once some African Americans move in, then you've got this phenomenon of white flight, where respectable white people didn't want to live in an African American neighborhood and would leave. So you get this concentration of African Americans in the middle of this enormous city, and so Harlem becomes kind of the center of both black political and cultural endeavors in the post-war period. And there's a flourishing, well, of African-American politics, but in particular, African-American cultural endeavors. And a lot of the African-American intellectuals at the time, no matter their political disagreements, agreed that one way that African-Americans could advance themselves was show their cultural achievements. And this was, you know, the great idea of the Harlem Renaissance, by achievements, particularly in the high arts, like literature in particular. African-Americans could show that they were worthy, or they deserved equal rights. And so this is the environment in which Paul and Essie meet each other, undergo their courtship, and get married. And, I mean, Robeson goes through this strange period where he's graduated from university. He's a football star. He's known throughout America. He takes a law degree and then discovers that it's almost impossible for an African-American man to practice law. I mean, he does briefly practice, and then there's an incident where he tries to get a secretary to write down a letter for him, and she says, I don't take dictation from an African-American man, though she doesn't use the term African-American man, and he walks out. So Paul sort of stumbles into show business more or less because there aren't that many other options available to him. He becomes a singer and an actor in the early to mid-20s simply because he's clearly talented and he's clearly charismatic, but none of the conventional professions are open to him.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah, listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Jeff Sparrow. We're talking about No Way But This, In Search of Paul Robeson. And Jeff, as you just mentioned, Paul's career has got going. He started out as a singer, he's started doing some acting roles. He quite quickly gets some major successes under his belt and starts to get some leading roles, which is obviously an incredible achievement for an African-American man at that time. But of course, you know, the industry is dominated by white people, owned by white people, the stuff is written by white people. And so a lot of the roles that he's getting, even if they're leading roles, are, you know, compromised, would look quite racist from our sort of modern perspective. And indeed, at the time, he starts to get criticism from the black intellectuals of Harlem, doesn't he?
Yes. I mean, the first major role he has is in the Eugene O'Neill play, All God's Children Got Wings. And it's a play about an interracial relationship. And as you say, many African-American intellectuals saw it as kind of demeaning, as expressing the sort of conventional views about what an interracial relationship entailed. At the same time, when the play was in rehearsal, a photograph of Robeson on stage with the other main actor was circulated to the press, and because it showed an African-American man kissing the hand of a white woman, the play became incredibly controversial. The KKK said they were going to bomb the opening night. A newspaper in Charleston said the entire performance was an invitation to a lynching, and it had to take place with a guard of steel workers protecting the dressing room. And so this was the constant dilemma that faced. I mean, he struggled to get good roles, as you say, but the racism directed against him was so overwhelming. So you see this same dynamic occurring again and again throughout his career, where he would be given a role that in many ways was demeaning or partial or minor, and he would have to try and turn it into something else by sheer force of charisma. And even when he became a Hollywood star, one of the first African-American, you know, box office draws, it would be the same thing, that very few directors knew how to direct a charismatic African-American lead, and there were very few scripts available. So particularly as an actor, I mean, it was somewhat easier as a musician because as a singer he was less reliant on other people. But I think you have to say throughout his acting career he very rarely got the parts that he deserved.
Both Paul and Essie end up in London. Paul's starring in Showboat, the show that Old Man River, who's what becomes his signature tune, is from. And, you know, that's a success. He becomes quite a star in London. And they end up staying on for a few years. So how different is their life in London?
They come to London partly to pursue the opportunities that are opening up for all there, but it's also that they see London at first as a relief from the brutal racism that dominates, you know, Jim Crow America. Essie at one point contrasts the experience of being in London, where she could go to a fashionable restaurant and hear these elegant women talking about what a great performance Paul Robeson had just given. And then when they were back in New York, they would have to use the servants' entrances to go into buildings. So in the early years in London, they more or less threw themselves into becoming part of respectable London society. And for a while, they were kind of feted about everywhere. They met the royal family. They were, you know, going to soirees. They were kind of establishing themselves as part of the English establishment. And it was one of the real turning points in Paul's life when he discovered that, in fact, they had never really been quite as accepted as he thought that they were.
Now, there's a chapter in this book where you talk about Paul's incredible affinity with Wales and with the Welsh mining community in particular. This was my favourite part of the book, because it was a story I was not aware of at all. Tell us this story.
Just to give the context for it, I mean, Robeson had an affair. I mean, he had many affairs throughout his life. He had an affair with a white woman. He was determined to marry her. He came back to Europe to do this, and she broke it off with him because he thought of his skin colour. And that left Robeson absolutely crushed. He thought he'd overcome that, and he discovered that, in fact, he was still seen as a second-class. What helped him recover from that was his burgeoning relationship with the British labour movement, in particular the labour movement of Wales, in particular the Welsh miners. And there's a great story about this, that at some point in the late 20s, Robeson hears this beautiful singing coming from the street in London, and he goes down to see what it is. And, in fact, it's a group of unemployed Welsh miners who have come to London looking for assistance. They've been locked out in their village in the Rhondda Valley, and they're singing as they march along in their work clothes and their big heavy boots, those beautiful Welsh hymns and harmonies. And Robeson goes down to join them. He marches along with them. He joins in their songs. He gives them a performance of some of his songs, and then provides them with a donation sufficient that they could travel back to Wales and feed their families. And it's just the beginning of, I mean, in the book I write about it almost as a love affair between Robeson and Wales. He would go back and forth there repeatedly. You know, he would give benefit performances for the miners. And in one of his better films, The Proud Valley, he kind of dramatizes a point that he made over and over again in interviews, that he saw this affinity between himself and the Welsh. He talked about how he'd grown up in a community of oppressed people in a small town where they'd taken great succour from the church and from music. And he said that was the same experience in the Welsh mining towns, where, you know, the mining chapels were so important and the music was so important. So he saw some sort of affinity there, and it was really part of the process, his process of politicisation. He moved from the United States, where he'd obviously been conscious of the oppression of African-American people, but once he'd come to London, he began to see that the contours of oppression were somewhat different from those that had presented themselves to him when he was in America, and that he saw the British working class as an ally in the struggle with which he began increasingly to identify.
And the feeling was reciprocated. You visit Wales and you talk to some people about the affection with which Paul Robeson is still held in Wales, don't you?
Yeah, look, that really blew me away. I mean, I'd never been to Wales before, but again and again when I was there, I would meet generally older people, but people who would tell me that, you know, when I was a child, my father brought me to see Paul Robeson and, you know, he pointed at Robeson and said, "There, son, there's the greatest man you will ever meet." And you would get this again and again. People knew the songs, but they also knew the history, and there was a sense of kind of, there was a sense of Robeson representing a notion of solidarity that had been incredibly important in Wales in the past and that people often looked back to with a degree of nostalgia, I guess. That this was, even though the past in Wales had been very hard, it had been a past that had been alleviated by this sense of collectivity that someone like Robeson had exemplified.
I'm Emma-Jane Unsworth. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
And so if we carry on talking about Paul's continuing political awakening, what did the Spanish Civil War mean to him?
When he was in Britain, he'd come into contact with students, African students in particular, who were studying in London, and they'd talk to him about decolonisation. So that had become part of his politics. But he also became aware of the political crisis unfolding in Europe. He'd been travelling through Germany in 1934, and when he was in Berlin, he was nearly attacked by some German stormtroopers. And he said afterwards that the incident had reminded him of a lynching in the south of America. And that convinced him that the rise of fascism was a worldwide problem, that it wasn't something that African-American people could afford to ignore, and that there was, in fact, a continuity between that and white supremacy in the United States. And, of course, Spain, where a left-wing government had been democratically elected and then faced a military coup by fascist generals, had become the great battleground against fascism. And that was sort of exemplified by the International Brigade, which was a multiracial, multi-ethnic army of anti-fascist volunteers from all over the world who had come to Spain to fight against fascism. And, you know, before I began work on the book, I knew something about the International Brigades. I mean, there were Australians who fought and died in Spain, but I hadn't realised quite how significant it had been to African Americans. It was a sizable contingent of African Americans who'd gone over there to fight against fascism in Spain. And so Paul had played a big role in raising money to support the International Brigades, but he also went over to Spain in the midst of the war to support the anti-fascist side. And so he and Essie had journeyed, you know, through a war zone to sing to these soldiers as they were going off to fight and die. And I went to Spain following in Robeson's footsteps, and it was some of the most moving part of my travels, I guess. I talked to an old man who remembered hearing Paul sing, and that experience had changed his life. But also in Madrid, you can see the lines of the trenches where the fascists had been just outside the walls of Madrid when Paul was there. And, you know, Paul had sung through amplifiers to the anti-fascists, but the Republicans had also broadcast that into the fascist trenches as a way of trying to demoralise the fascist soldiers. You know, and it's a very kind of real example of using art as a weapon in a way that I'd never really come across. You know, here is this guy whose his voice is being used to fight fascism in Spain, and I just thought that was extraordinary.
So the Second World War comes along, and Paul is publicly supportive of the war effort in the US. At this time also, he has a big hit with Othello on Broadway and a tour of Othello around the States. But, like, not long after the war is when things start to go downhill for him, isn't it, politically in the States?
That's right. So the other aspect of Robeson's politics is his enthusiasm for the Soviet Union, which he visits for the first time in 1935, and thereafter he's a impassioned supporter of the Soviet regime and the Soviet system for the rest of his life. And that's a controversial position to some degree in the 30s. In the 40s, when at least when the Second World War breaks out, it's less controversial. he goes back to the US, and as you say, he supports the war effort. And of course, it's often forgotten during that time, the Soviet Union was America's great ally. In fact, there was a rush of pro-Soviet propaganda that was being put out by the American government and the American film industry, this long string of kind of pro-Soviet film. So in that period, Robeson's background as an anti-fascist and his kind of democratic credentials make him a kind of both a popular figure, and he uses his popularity to campaign against segregation and against racism. But it also means that in some ways his politics in that time are kind of in line with that of the American government that's using him to help win support against the fascists and for the war effort. Once the Second World War ends, of course, almost immediately the war against the Germans is replaced by the Cold War against the Soviet Union. And very quickly, Robeson moves from being, you know, public hero to being a public enemy. I mean, there's a famous incident where he is performing in upstate New York in a town called Peekskill, where a local newspaper kind of whips up a anti-communist demonstration where tens of thousands of right-wingers descend on the concert grounds, you know, chanting anti-communist slogans but also anti-Semitic and racist slogans, and they hang Robeson in effigy, and he's very lucky to escape with his life. And from then on in, he really becomes Pete Seeger, the folk singer, describes Robeson as the most blacklisted man during the McCarthy period. And it's very much the case. The FBI makes an effort to ensure that no venues will allow Robeson to sing anywhere. No record stores will carry his records. No theatres will show his films. He can't get acting work anywhere. And they also confiscate his passport. So not only can he not perform in the United States, but he can't leave the US to travel anywhere else. So there is a concerted and very deliberate campaign to silence Robeson throughout the 50s. And for some years, it's quite a successful effort.
And so how does Paul see out the remaining years of his life then? What happens to his career after this blacklisting period?
I mean, he continues to campaign to get his passport back through the 50s. He's called before HUAC, which is the House Committee on Un-American Activities, the sort of major organ of the McCarthyites. And he very famously gives a very defiant performance at HUAC. They ask him, well, you know, if you're so critical of the United States, why don't you leave? And he says, because my father was a slave and because my people died to build this country, and I'm going to stay here and have a piece of it just like you, and no fascist-minded people are going to drive me from it. Is that clear? And it's just, you know, this sort of great moment that sort of, you know, really confounds the white senators who are interrogating him. And a few years after that, the political climate is shifting. The civil rights movement is on the march, and Robeson gets his passport back. He embarks on a comeback tour over the world. He plays Othello again in England. He travels to Australia, does a very famous concert on the steps of on what becomes the Sydney Opera House site, where he sings to the workers who are building that hall. And it seems like he's kind of triumphed and he's beat off the Cold War red baiters. And then in 1961, he's found unconscious on the floor of a hotel room in Moscow, having slit his wrists in an attempt to commit suicide. And from there on in, his life is never... That's really the end of his public career, that Eslander organises, you know, treatment for him in various countries. He's subjected to very large doses of electroconvulsive therapy. He's given huge amounts of drugs. And he kind of recovers. He recovers enough to go back to America, and he gives a few other public performances, but he's never really the same. And largely the rest of his life, he's lived out in more or less seclusion. There are various other suicide attempts that happen, but from there on in, he's essentially a changed figure. And it's a very sad ending to his life.
Just to finish it off then, so having been in search of Paul Robeson, having discovered him, what do you think Robeson's legacy is?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. I guess the reason why I wanted to do the book, and I mean, this became even stronger with me the further I got into it, is I was struck by how much the the themes of Paul Robeson's life, you know, the legacy of slavery, the persistence of racism in the United States, the effects of economic turmoil and unemployment, the relationship between art and politics, the rise of the far right. I was struck by how relevant all of those themes were now in the 21st century. In some ways, they're more relevant, you know, in the past few years than they have been for a long time. But I was also struck everywhere I went by the extent to which this was a history that was kind of largely forgotten. Not just Robeson's life is forgotten, but, you know, the legacy of fascism in Spain was something that was largely forgotten. The legacy of the Soviet Union in Russia is something that most Russians know almost nothing about. And likewise, when I was in the US, Americans seem unable to come to terms with the legacy of racism and slavery. And so I guess the argument I wanted to make with the book is not so much that we can simply recreate Paul Robeson's ideas and his struggles, because we can't. They're very much part of an era that's past. But I think that if we're going to tackle those issues as we confront them today, we have to first come to terms with what happened in the 20th century and the way that those particular struggles played out then. And I think that it's only by coming to terms with kind of that buried history that we'll come up with, you know, answers that can resolve the problems that we face today. So that, and I think that the story of Paul Robeson is part of that process.
Brilliant. So I've been talking to Jeff Sparrow, who is the author of No Way But This, In Search of Paul Robeson, which is out now in the UK from Scribe Books. Jeff, thank you so much for telling me Paul's story.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.